We are now audio recording. So welcome all again to the Q&A for this evening. And we have quite a few things in the deck, but we should have some time available if people have other problems or questions or anything like that they want to throw into the chat or ask later on. By all means, do so. So with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through the deck. And Alan, are you muted? There you go.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome, everyone. As Chris said, we have quite a bit of material. Starting with a share from one Chris.
Okay, and I'm just going to paste this into the chat window as promised before I start talking to it. And so this was actually something that Linda, my girlfriend, came up with, Radio Garden. So an interesting site. You go to it, and you can... go do audio streaming of, I think it's thousands of radio stations from around the world. So the URL is on the screen there, radio.garden, and if you do /search, it'll bring you into that screen where you can search for a particular radio station, or you can just zoom around the globe, zoom in, zoom out, click on any of the green dots, which may be one or more radio stations associated with a green dot. And stream the material. You can search, you can save favorites, all the rest of it. And I played around with it a little bit. It seems pretty cool. So just an idea if anybody wants to stream radio stations.
That's the new person shortwave radio, I guess.
I guess.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Chris is on deck again for the next chat.
Yeah, this is one that I came across. The guy who did this tutorial that's listed at the bottom, he is an ex-Microsoft employee, and he actually quit Microsoft to do YouTube videos full-time. And he's quite good. He's got a lot of tip videos that are excellent. And one of the ones that he came up with was the Open Broadcaster software, which is free and open source, and it's what he uses to do all of his YouTube videos. Very, very powerful software. You can configure it up to yin yang. It's quite amazing. You can blend all kinds of sources into your resulting video, things like your screen. You can have your microphone, video camera. You can put logos on mixed into it all with animations and all kinds of stuff. And it's free and open source. So obsproject.com, and it's a little bit overwhelming, I think, in terms of if you were to just pick it up and try to use it. So I highly recommend, if you are interested in doing this sort of thing, take a look at his beginner's tutorial. It's quite well done, and will give you a good running start on using OBS Studio.
Okay, thank you, Chris. And for those of you who are reading the pre-meeting deck, there was a slide in there about people who joined us by looking at links from other websites. And one of the ones we've been using recently is ottawaseniors.com. So if anyone is here because they saw our event listing on ottawaseniors.com, if you could just drop a message in the chat or send an email to Chris, then we'll know that we're actually having some useful effect. I guess the other one we've been using is Meetup. So that's the same kind of thing. If you're joining us from Meetup, then please let us know. Okay, moving on to the first question of the evening. We have a teacher of Tai Chi who's using Zoom and has a problem with the microphone. And Chris is going to chat about this.
Yeah, let me just check to see. So that was Gloria. Do we have Gloria with us tonight? I don't see a Gloria in the list. Okay, if she joins us, that'd be great. She might be able to input some extra information. So the whole idea was that as she was teaching Tai Chi over Zoom, of course, she would be moving back and forth and so forth. And the further away she got from the laptop, the sound of her was distorted and participants couldn't understand her instructions and things like that. So she tried various things. She tried adjusting the volume. She tried using an external USB microphone rather than the microphone that was built into the laptop. None of that seemed to help. And another problem that she ran across was in-session recording of these. Sometimes she ended up with the sound not synchronized with the video, and she was wondering for any help on either of those situations. So one thought was that a good idea would be, like, the sound quality is going to be very, very dependent on, I think, mostly the quality of the microphone and the type of microphone that you have, but also, of course, the distance that you are from the microphone, and it could be even the room causing echoes or things like that. So all of those things are likely to cause differences in the quality of the sound that you get out of it all. So I think one of the things I thought was, if using the tabletop microphone, you know, if that's the best microphone they have available to you, first off, going into the Zoom options, and first off, make sure you've got the right microphone selected. Just because you plug in an external microphone doesn't necessarily mean that the Zoom is going to pick up on that. So if you go into the audio settings and there's a drop-down list where on this one it says headset microphone USB audio device, so just make sure your right microphone is selected, and then play around with the various settings. You know, go to, you know, adjusting the volume up and down, selecting, deselecting, the automatically adjust the microphone volume. And then there are some options for suppressing background noise. I suspect that that's not actually the problem here of background noise, but why not try the different things? Maybe it is turned on and set to high, and maybe turning it to low, you know, might allow things to be working better or something like that, perhaps. I don't know. The music and professional audio, I looked a little bit at that. It doesn't look like in this case it's likely to be anything to do with it, but why not try it? And then there is an advanced button where you can go in and play with a couple of other settings as well. So just trying, making sure that you try out all of the options that are at your disposal within the Zoom might help the situation.
Chris, yep. Ellen's asking, how do you get into those options?
So in the if you're in a Zoom meeting, it'll be under either the mute or the stop video options at the toolbar at the bottom of the screen in Zoom. So if you just move your mouse down, the toolbar should show up, and the little chevrons that you get there will get you to the options. You can also, if you're not in a Zoom meeting, you can actually just run Zoom. If you click on start and type in Zoom, it'll come up with your Zoom client. And if you go into there, and then in the top right-hand corner, you can end up getting to the options screen from there. So either of those ways would allow you to do it. I noticed Michelin said use a directional microphone. That's what I was saying. The quality of the microphone is going to be, a big influencer on the quality of the sound. And the next hint from Tom is on my next slide. So try using a headset microphone. I use a headset microphone all the time when I'm on Zoom, and I've been told that, you know, there's no problems with the quality of the sound that people hear from me. So I certainly think that you'll get really good quality sound if you use a headset microphone. Now, if you use a wired one, you know, you may have an issue with trying to teach Tai Chi with a wired one, but there are wireless ones available as well. So you can get them 2.4 gigahertz or whatever, but you can also get Bluetooth, which I think probably is the best solution for something like a Tai Chi class. You could just connect Bluetooth to your laptop, use that, and you would probably get much, much better sound. And even as you turn around and so forth, the microphone stays in the same relative position to your mouth. So I think that the best quality of sound is likely to come from a Bluetooth wireless headset, and you can get them for about $50 on Amazon.ca. And then Tom had shared, this was just an idea. I don't know that this will apply, but you can always try it. So Tom at the January 20th Q&A talked about RTX Voice, which if you have a compatible video card, you can hook this up and it can cut out background noises. Now, for this particular situation, I don't know that this is going to be anything that will really apply, but it's always worth trying, and it's free. So if you have a compatible video card, go for it. And if you look at the URL there, it actually has the chat and the presentation material on that particular option. Now, the sound and video sync problems, I did some searching on that, and it seems that there's quite a few people that were complaining about it. I put in four URLs that I came across where people had various suggestions on things that, you know, may or may not apply and may or may not work. I really don't know, but it's the best that I could come up with. If anybody else on the Q&A tonight has any idea about problems on Zoom of sound and video syncing issues, please jump in and contribute to the conversation on that. And I'll post all of those URLs and everything like that into the chat.
I don't see anything in the chat window.
Yeah, nothing yet. So we can keep an eye out and revisit this topic if we see something pop in.
Okay. All right, so the next item is an issue with drive numbering, essentially. Are you going to talk to this, Chris?
I guess I can. So this was Stefan Richard who had this problem where Acronis TrueImage was reporting an error. And I'm guessing that this was not, well, I'm not sure if this was, it was always reporting it from the first time Acronis was used, or whether it was, it just suddenly popped up. I suspect from the way that the solution came about that it was always reporting this, but I'm not 100% sure. So it was reporting a read error or failure to read on hard disk one. And they went in and their computer had one magnetic hard drive, spinning hard drive, and a solid state drive. So they went to disk management to find out which disk was hard disk one. And they looked at that and they said, oh, okay, this looks like the 500 gigabyte solid state drive. So the next thing they did was, they looked up a little bit of information and they found that, you know, it failed to correctly read the data from the drive and so forth. Typically associated with the read error can occur with bad NAND flash, which would be the solid-state drive, or with bad SATA signal, so forth. They run the command checkdisk/F to fix and /R, which I think is read the entire surface on the SSD, and they said that they read that that doesn't work as the controller, you know, handles things differently. So checkdisk/F/R will not actually function properly on a solid-state drive. So the solid-state drive was 7 years old, and so they decided to just replace the solid-state drive. And the replacement drive had a utility to check health, and the new one was healthy, but Acronis was still reporting the same error. And so they looked into a little bit further, and lo and behold, they discovered that Acronis numbers drives differently than Windows does. So Acronis numbers the drives starting at 1. Windows Disk Management starts with 0. So Acronis was reporting disk 1 when it was actually drive 0 as far as Windows was concerned. So it was reporting an error on the spinning hard drive as opposed to an error on the solid-state drive. So to fix the problem, they did a checkdisk/F/R on the magnetic drive, which, of course, Windows, because it's the operating system drive, it can't lock the drive to actually perform that, so it runs it at the next reboot, which takes hours and hours if you've ever run this. I'm surprised that it actually only took 2.5 hours, because my experience with it is that I would have expected about 4 or 5 hours. And it actually did find and repaired bad sectors on the spinning hard drive. So my first thought on that was that they probably had no problem with the old solid-state drive, and it was probably perfectly fine and didn't need to be replaced. But I guess in the troubleshooting that went on, it just seemed to make more sense to just replace the solid-state drive. And it was only subsequent to that that they found out that it wasn't the solid-state drive that was actually the problem.
And Stefan's noting that it was a new error message.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I guess that does make sense. So it was an error developed on the spinning hard drive that threw up the new error message, and then the check disk actually did fix that. But don't throw out that old solid state drive, Stefan, because it sounds like it probably is still fine.
So a couple of things came in as follow-up on the headset issue. Jocelyn notes a video from OBS that was talking about sync. And Lawrence, and the URL is in the chat window, and Lawrence is saying another option to the Bluetooth headset is Bluetooth earbuds. More form-fitting, fits snugly, better movement, and no need to adjust the microphone.
But if it's Bluetooth earbuds, you don't have, I presume, you don't have a microphone with that as well, right? You would still be counting on the microphone either in the laptop or on the desk, I would presume. Or let me know.
I think it must be a mic. Come on, okay. Lawrence, say something. You're unmuted.
Lawrence, do you know if the Bluetooth earbuds that you're talking about incorporate a microphone?
He's got to plug them in so he can use them.
Just while he's doing that, I'll comment on the going back on the OBS talking about sync. I saw that one, and I think it only applies if you're using OBS to do the recording of your session. So I don't think it will apply in this particular circumstance, but I guess a person could try OBS to do the recording rather than just count on Zoom's recording. Would be a possibility, I suppose. I don't know.
Chris, quick comment?
Yeah.
I have a pair of Bluetooth earbuds that are probably 5 years old, and they have a mic on board.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I was attempting to show that and then took it out of the case only to have it interrupt both the mic and the speaker during the call. So, anyways, I will show it without
without plugging
it out of
again.
The case.
Okay.
And, yes, it does have a microphone, and it's a half-decent microphone.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that would be another option, too. I don't mind wearing a headset. But if it's another way that some people might prefer, that'd be great. So I really think that person who was having the problem, that part of their problem would go away completely if they went to something that was a Bluetooth connected microphone, either a headset or the earbuds. I think that would solve that problem for $50 or less.
And going back to the check disk problem, Tom is noting that check disk/B will try to recover bad blocks.
Yeah, and I assume that's one of the, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Tom, but I assume that's one of the functions that won't work on an SSD. That for an SSD, it won't do a surface check and it won't do a recover bad blocks. It will do the logical checks for sure. So just the check disk/F would be fine on an SSD because it will check the logical consistency of the SSD, but I think the /B and the /R won't work on an SSD, but I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, Tom doesn't know.
Okay.
And Lawrence is saying kudos for the different drive numbering system. He's experienced the same problem with other programs. And it's always a problem to figure out which drive is causing the problem.
Yeah, that's insane that anybody would number drives differently than Windows is going to number it. Because if you're having an issue, you know, you're always going to be referring back to the way that Windows enumerates the drives. And why any company would enumerate the drives differently is beyond me.
I've encountered the issue with drives and arrays, especially.
Yeah.
It's dumbfounding. And if you're dealing with a mission critical server, well, that just ups the tension in the room when you're trying to figure out what drive number is really failing on you.
Yeah, and actually, Alan, to your point, Linux could number them differently. I should correct myself. Any program should enumerate them the same way they are enumerated by the operating system that you're running on.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So Tom is noting a few utility programs that can check and possibly recover sectors.
Okay, I just not scrolled down enough. Okay, yep, oh, that's great.
And Gosselin's going back to the Zoom microphone issue and asking, would the limited distance for Bluetooth be a problem if somebody's moving around the room?
Bluetooth's good for about 30 feet. So.
And that's what Bob is saying, it's good for 30 feet in a different room even. So.
Yeah, so if you're further away from your computer than 30 feet, it could be an issue.
Okay.
Certainly, if you're more than 30 feet away, the microphone on your laptop is not going to work very well either. So, still your best option.
That's good information, and I know that the Gloria will pick it up from the posted material on the website.
That's great.
Okay, so moving along, I have a share, the most bizarre solution in the world. Talking about Linux, if you have a disk partition in Linux, then it has to be mounted before it can be used. So, as you know, I have a dedicated data partition, which is mounted as a name data disk in Linux, and it shows up as drive D in Windows. And in Linux, it's mounted as read-write using a command in the file system table. Recently, I opened Linux and looked at my email, and the mail client Thunderbird couldn't load because it said there was a disk issue. So I loaded my maintenance log file into my word processor, and it came up as read-only. So clearly, my whole data drive has set as read-only, even though I told it to be read-write. So the fix is very interesting. The fix is boot into Windows and disable fast start. So if you go into Windows, go to the control panel and go to this link here, change what the power buttons do, and uncheck turn on fast start up, and then reboot the computer and boot it back into Linux. And now the data disk works perfectly as a read-write drive, as it should. So even Albert didn't know what the solution was. So if anybody has any bright ideas why booting into Windows and turning off fastboot makes Linux work properly, please let me know.
I know exactly why. And it comes from the fact I talked a little bit about this at the last Q&A about what happens when you have fast start enabled. And I actually have an article coming up specifically dealing with, and I'm just trying to look, but yeah, I don't think it hasn't been published. Oh yeah, it's been submitted, called Fast Startup. And I go into some more detail about this. What is happening is if you have fast startup enabled and you shut down your computer, it closes all your programs, it writes the current state of the computer to the hibernation file, and then it shuts down. If you then boot into Linux, that drive is locked, because what's going to happen the next time you boot into Windows, it's going to read the hibernation file. What if the disk has changed because you did something in Linux and it reads the hibernation file, and things are not matching. It could screw up things royally. So Windows also locks the drive when it shuts down, so that if you use an alternate operating system or another version of Windows running on the same computer, it doesn't accidentally or otherwise screw up that drive. That's exactly why it's happening, and you can't go get around it. The only way is the way you had it, where you disable fast startup so it doesn't rate the current state of the computer to the hibernation file, and when it starts up completely fresh.
Okay, now I have to fess up that this fix actually was applied probably 2 years ago. But the problem occurred yesterday. So if fast startup was already disabled, how did it happen this second time?
Well, I'm sure it's because Microsoft knew that you must want your computers to sound faster.
Oh, yeah. And okay.
So just silently improve your situation, right?
Oh, yeah. Could very well be. Oh, I give up. Don't jailboot your system in the answer. I mean. Okay, moving on. We had a number of smart apps early on. And we said that you can also tell us about useful programs. So if you have an Android app that you like, or a utility program, or some kind of PC program that you like, send us a note and we'll broadcast it to the world. And Stuart takes that literally and tells us about a program he's been using recently called Network Cell Info. It's an app for an Android smartphone. And it basically looks around. It's basically a Wi-Fi sniffer. It looks around and tells you all about the wireless systems that are around you. There's a free version, but Stuart just bought the ad-free version. He says not the pro version for $3.07. And he's hoping he'll learn all about wireless using that. Second thing, if you're buying apps from Google Play or obtaining apps from Google Play, you can actually share them, apps, games, movies, and TV shows, ebooks, audiobooks, with up to 5 family members using the Google Play family library. So if that's of interest to you, here's Stuart's link to the Google Play family library. I have an app favorite for you. I had a problem a while ago where the battery on my smartphone was running down, and I needed to figure out why. And I did some research on the web, and people were suggesting GSAM, which is a battery monitoring app. And it seems to actually work quite well. It's fairly well featured. There's a free version of it. So you get an optional status bar where you can add the battery state and time life estimates, so forth. You can overlay the stock icon with one of GSAM versions. You can tell it that you'd like to see statistics for a specific period of time, things like from the last plug-in, from the last charge, that kind of thing. And you can also see average data, so you can find out how long your battery normally runs for. They have an app-in-app version called AppSucker, where it's trying to tell you how much power different apps are using, and hence which one is the baddie that's draining your battery. And I say perhaps, and you'll see why in a second. And the other thing you can do is you can set alarms for things like low charge, high temperature, and problems with the battery health and so forth. So the program, when you run it, basically gives you some basic information, how much charge you've got left, the temperature of your CPU, And then what kind of usage you had from various things, like using the phone or the display screen, how much Wi-Fi time's being used and that kind of thing. But at the bottom here, you've got some icons. And this icon right here will take you to the charts. So, for example, you can see here, I've got a spread of a couple of days. The battery starts off about 40%, starts to run down. It clearly gets charged overnight. And then it starts to be used throughout the day. And then it's giving me a projection. If I keep going at this rate, I'm going to end up down here somewhere with zero charge. I can also overlay other things, the phone signal, the rate of charge, the temperature on the graph. And so here you can see the temperature of the phone. And clearly when it goes into its overnight charge, the temperature drops off because it's not really doing anything except a trickle charge kind of deal. And another chart you can have is CPU. Now, if that tells you anything, have a nice day, because it doesn't really help me very much. But those are the kind of charts you can get with this app. This is the AppSucker app, the in-app app. And it's basically telling me that 8% of my battery is being consumed by something, which isn't terribly useful. When I first got the phone, it would give me a list of all the apps and give me the percentages of usage and that kind of thing. And now it doesn't. But if I check on the help file, it turns out that recent versions of Android, Android Nougat, which I think is 9 and later, they don't permit apps to gather CPU utilization from other apps. So GSAM can't tell you which ones individually are using the CPU. So it just drops them all into this one bucket, which isn't terribly useful. Anyway, if you have a problem with your phone or tablet battery, GSAM has at least some capabilities to tell you some of the things that are going on there. So it can be quite useful.
And Tom pasted into the chat that he uses Accubat, A-C-C-U-B-A-T on Android, and he gave the URL to the app on the Google Play Store. So there's another one you could try out as well.
And it looks like it also has alarms and just keeping the battery between 20% and 63% is good for long life.
Right.
Okay, another question that came in was, what are the pros and cons of either cloning a drive versus backing up a drive using disk imaging software, something like Aomi? So I thought about this a little bit, and in terms of disk imaging, all of the software programs that do disk imaging are pretty much the same. So I've never used Aomi, so I really don't know, but I'm sure it does the same kind of things as Macrium or Chrislights and Aesis to do backup. I use Macrium Reflect, but they pretty well do the same kind of stuff. So if you clone a drive, you actually do an exact copy, a bit-for-bit copy of the original disk on a second drive. So that means that you can remove the original disk from the computer, plug in the clone, and the computer will boot as normal from the clone drive because it's an exact copy of your original disk. If you make a backup image, you get a copy of everything on the disk, the operating system, all of the applications, all of the data, all of the configurations. Everything on the disk is copied into a single file, a backup image file. And that file is usually compressed to save space, and you can get multiple copies on one drive. But what that means is that if your drive fails, then you have to restore that image using the original imaging software to a new drive. Or if it's a backup, you can restore it to the original drive. For example, if you screw up your first drive. Some of the issues. Because you're making a bit-for-bit copy, the disk that you're cloning to has to be exactly the same size or at least bigger than the original drive. You clearly can't make a clone of a big drive on a smaller drive because it's a bit-for-bit copy. But cloning is usually just a one-time operation. And you normally do it because you have a new drive and you want to copy all of the data from your old drive onto the new drive. And you generally only do that once. The good thing about backup imaging is that because you're compressing the images, you can generally store multiple backups on one external USB drive, for example. And backups are also much more flexible. You can make a full disk image backup, so you can have everything in one shot in one file, which is a, at that moment, a copy of your hard drive. You can do incremental backups. So you do a full backup, which gives you a master copy, and then the incremental backups just record the changes from day to day. So if you want to restore, you restore the master, the first backup, the first full backup, and then you restore as many incrementals as you want to get to the point in time where you want the disk to be restored. And there's also a third method, which not very many people use, I think, which is called differential. And differential is a bit like incremental. You do a full backup, which gives you a master, and then subsequent backups just back up the differences. But it does all of the differences from the master. So if you have multiple differentials, you restore the full backup and the one differential to the point when you want to restore the drive. Incrementals, obviously, if you're going to do multiple copies like that, incremental is probably the way to go because they're smaller and they're faster.
And if I can interject there just for a second, Alan, I know that EaseUS to do backup works this way, and I presume all of them will. On incremental, if you have to do a restore, you don't actually restore the full and then each incremental. You just point to the incremental file that you want to restore from. It will automatically put together from the full and all incrementals before then, so it does it all in a single operation. And certainly from the performance or time point of view, incrementals are wonderful. I do a full backup I just switched every 2 months, and then incrementals in between. The incrementals run in a matter of about 3 minutes, whereas the full backup takes about 2.5 hours. So incrementals are wonderful.
It's very dependent on your hard drive. My full backups take 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I was going to say that whether you do full incremental or differential, you don't really have to worry about restoring because the software takes care of that automatically, as Chris said.
Yeah.
It's really easy. Another advantage of backups is that you can schedule them. So, as Chris says, he makes his full backup, and then the incremental is probably scheduled for 2 o'clock every morning.
Yeah.
For a month or something. And another really nice feature of backups is if you take a disk image, you can actually mount that image inside the backup, the imaging software, and it mounts it as a virtual drive. So now you can access individual files or folders from your backup and then copy that directly to your live hard drive. So you can pick out one file and restore it, for example, from the backup image when it's mounted. So it's a really very useful function. And I know Tom is has entered in the chat window Clonezilla. And if you're not familiar with Clonezilla, it's a Linux-based system where you create a live CD, DVD, USB. You can run Clonezilla, and you can make disk images, you can image partitions, you can recover anything you want directly from that software. Again, it's free and open source software, and it's really good as a standalone system. A lot of people that use Linux, of course, don't use Windows software, so something like Clonezilla is really very useful. Okay, I think this is our last question prepared, at least for the evening. How can you revive a dead computer? And this is Micheline's problem. If you've been following the members forum, you know that Micheline has been researching purchasing a new computer. And she's clearly annoyed the Windows 7 gods, because today her Windows 7 desktop refused to boot. So maybe all that research is going to come in very handy. Anyway, her desktop runs both Windows 7 and Windows 10. But when she boots it now, it boots into something called Asus Express Gate. And when she exits from Express Gate, it's telling her to reboot and use the correct device, or put a boot medium into the device and press any key. Now, her problem is that she doesn't have a Windows 7 disk available. But fortunately, she has all her data backed up until quite recently on an external drive. But the question is, can she recover her desktop operating system? Well, I was intrigued by this Asus Express Gate. And it turns out it's quite interesting. It's a Linux-based system that's integrated on the motherboard, and you can enable it in BIOS, and you can have access to the internet using Firefox, email, Skype, and so on, and while the real operating system is still loading. Never heard of that before. It sounds kind of interesting. But I guess it doesn't help you if you really want to get into Windows 7. So things to try. If there's a backup image available, and it's not in this case, but if my machine decided it wasn't going to boot, the first thing I would probably try and do is restore a backup and see if that would do it. Another thing you can definitely try is to download the Windows 10 installation tool. And Microsoft has a website where you can download that tool. And then you can use the tool, and what you want to do is create installation media. And that will let you create a live DVD or a USB. You then boot from that installation device and see if you can either repair or reinstall Windows 10. And clearly you can do that because here is an example of running the live USB. It gives you a setup screen, and then when you go to next, you can either choose to repair your computer, or at least try to repair your computer, or if that fails, then you can try doing a full installation by installing now. If the machine isn't going to boot, what else can you do? You can also obviously try and recover the data that you have on the system up to date if you can access the hard drive. One of the ways to try and do that is to create a live DVD or a live USB of a Linux distro. So you plug the USB into the computer, you boot into Linux, and see if Linux can access your Windows hard drive. If it can, then you plug in an external USB drive, portable drive or desktop drive or something, and copy all your current data onto that second drive. if you can't access the drive, well, now you're into that problem where you have to replace the hard drive. But you got a Windows 7 machine, and that means it's a pretty old machine, I think. And Michelin's been looking at probably trying to replace the computer. So rather than replace the hard drive, might be the time to think about replacing the computer. Another thing you can try doing if all else fails is ripping the hard drive out of the computer. The computer's not going to work. And can you recover the data from the hard drive another way? One of the ways to try and do that is to get a USB external disk enclosure. And this is actually showing a 2.5-inch, I think, drive from a laptop. But it's the same kind of problem if you have a 3.5-inch desktop drive. You just need a bigger case, basically. And inside the case is some circuitry, and you plug the drive into the circuitry, connect the drive now to a USB port on a second computer, and see if you can access the disk. Bob Harris had suggested another option. This isn't the one that Bob has, but it's a docking adapter. And the nice thing about these things is that they have multiple disk formats. So almost any type of disk, SATA, IDE, whatever, will plug into one of the slots. And again, it's a USB type device, so you can connect it as an external drive and try and recover your data. I don't know if anybody else has any other bright ideas to help Micheline boot her computer. Those are all of the things I could think of.
Tom mentioned in the chat that if recovering a discarded obsolete computer off crack can ascertain certain XP Vista passwords. It also works on Windows 10, just basically does brute force attack. And he says it's another good reason to have admin passwords that are greater than 20 characters long. One of the problems that you can run into on some computers is a lot of the more modern computers, when you install Windows, if it is modern enough, it may turn on full disk encryption automatically. Or you can actually turn on full disk encryption manually. If you do that and your computer dies and then you stick this into an external enclosure, you ain't going to see nothing because it's all encrypted.
Kavahenda is saying, what if the computer is an Apple? And the answer is, go to the Bytown Mac user group or something yeah. like that. Our PC user group, we don't really support Apple. A few people know some things about things like iPads and so forth, but I don't know how you would recover an Apple computer that wasn't booting.
If you use Time Machine, which as I understand it, all Apple users use for all their backups, you can actually do a recovery from a Time Machine backup by you would basically replace your existing system disk, and then you plug in your Time Machine backup drive, you turn on your Mac, it says, oh, do you want to restore your computer from the Time Machine backup? You say yes, you come back a couple hours later, and it's done. So Time Machine on a Mac is a wonderful piece of software for backup and recovery.
Chris, if I could add a quick comment to that on the Mac?
Yeah, sure, Dave.
My wife did that she replaced her hard drive with an SSD about 6 months ago, and it was as easy as what you just described.
Yeah, it's incredible. Well, I guess when you own the entire ecosystem, hardware and software, it is a lot easier to do. But my understanding is that Time Machine is just the dream backup and recovery system.
So just for my information, is Time Machine, does it run automatically, or is it like one of these disk imaging programs where you have to install and run it on demand sort of thing?
I think if you plug in an external hard drive, the Apple OS will ask you, do you want to use this as a time machine drive? And if you say yes, it just works. And it, as long as you leave that thing plugged in, it will do something like keeping your backups to the day for the last week and to the week for the last month, and then earlier than that forever until it runs out of room, and then it just automatically keeps it cleaned up for new stuff going on there. So you should be able to, if you leave that drive plugged into your Apple computer, it will be recoverable at least to the day, you know, going back, you know, quite a bit. And so it's, it's just all automatic. You just plug it in and it works.
Okay, Claudette is asking about a Bell network. It was connected by default via WFS, Wi-Fi protected setup, which I found out is considered insecure. I turned it off and turned MAC filtering on. The alternative, which allows to select devices which have access to the network. It didn't ask for a username or password, so I'm wondering if it's using WPA2 and functions using the same username and password as my network and would therefore be secure. It's not known to be secure when I access the network on the web. The network on the web. How do I secure it?
I could address a couple of those issues for sure. I give a presentation at the OPL on how to secure a home wireless network. First off, Wi-Fi protected setup, it does have insecurities. There are only 11,000 possible password combinations. And the early implementations of Wi-Fi protected setup were definitely bad because it basically was there and always available. And so anybody who was in radio range, all they had to do was try a maximum of 11,000 combinations before they would get into your network. Newer implementations of it are not so bad. Typically now, your router will have a button on it that you press that button. It activates Wi-Fi protected setup for, a couple of minutes, and then it automatically turns itself off. So it allows you to go in and, you want to connect a new computer. You just hit the button and then you go to your computer. You say you want to connect and it'll just go ahead and do it. So it's not so bad if it's in that mode. If you don't have that mode where you can press a button and it only is activated for a couple of minutes, then I would definitely leave it disabled. MAC filtering, I wouldn't bother. MAC filtering, the idea behind it is that, every networking device has a MAC address, media access control, nothing to do with Apple. And it is unique worldwide, or should be unique worldwide. So somebody had the bright idea to say that if you go into your router and say, well, only allow the following MAC address to connect, and you look up the MAC address of your computer, you plug it in, then only your computer would be able to connect. Well, unfortunately, it's pretty trivial to spoof a MAC address, and it's also trivial to get MAC addresses of existing computers that are connected to a Wi-Fi network. So you can sniff a MAC address quite easily, and then you could spoof it on your computer and connect using that MAC address. So it will only make it more inconvenient for you to use your own computer network. It doesn't make it any more difficult for the hackers. So I never bother with MAC address filtering. Going on from there, you say it didn't ask for a username and password. I'm assuming that's from a computer that was already had connected to the router. And if that's the case, then if you didn't change the password, then it will continue to function properly. If it's a brand new computer that you turned on and it connected and it didn't ask for a username and password, I would be concerned. And in that case, it hasn't, the ability to pass a username and password automatically is definitely not a function of WPA2. And so if you have WPA2 turned on, any new device should certainly ask for a password to connect to the computer. So I would say that, and if you wanted to really test that, you can go into Windows and you can tell it to forget about your network, your wireless network, and then try connecting to it again, and it should prompt you for the password. So if you have any questions about how to have it forget the network, I don't know right off the top of my head, email me and I can send you the instructions on how to tell your computer to forget about your Wi-Fi network. And does that, Claudette, if that doesn't answer all your questions, jump in. We did have another thing earlier on in the chat from B asking, and this goes back to the Bluetooth earbuds. So if anybody who has been using Bluetooth earbuds, do you have a recommended brand for Bluetooth earbuds with mic? And do you know if the Bluetooth mic will still allow you to share music from the computer? That should be completely independent. So when you're connected over some kind of video conferencing, you should have microphone as well as the ability to pass system sounds, which is independent of the microphone. And they said if you use the mic and the laptop and you share music from the laptop application. If your video conferencing application has the ability to pass on system sounds, then that should be doable. I'm not sure if Zoom actually does. So anybody on the Bluetooth mic earbuds with mic, do you have any recommendations for brands?
We have successfully used played our music on the PC and used both an external mic or the internal mic for the voice. But there's a little bit of problem of getting the ratio adjusted so that you can hear the voice over the music. And as the Tai Chi teacher mentioned, as you go further back in the class, your voice obviously gets softer. So this might be a good solution as long as it still allows you to play the music on the computer.
Yeah, at least you wouldn't have that problem of the balance changing as you get further closer. So
once you got it, once you got it set up, it would.
Now, I'm not sure about the system sounds though. Whether does anybody know if Zoom actually passes on system sounds?
Well, we've done that.
You have? Okay.
Yeah. We played music on iTunes.
Okay.
Played music through iTunes and used both the computer, the mic in the computer, which seems actually to work better than I had also an external mic. That didn't seem to work quite as well.
Okay.
So Tom's saying he likes the Jabra 65E noise cancelling neckless headphones. And Lawrence says he purchased Samsung Bud Plus that he's happy with, but he suggests checking reviews for earbuds that stay in place if you're very active.
Mm. Yeah, good point. You don't want to have to tape them on.
And Tom says his son has Apple earbuds with a mic that sounds great at his end. And I think we scared off Micheline because she wants to know if anybody can recommend a repair shop to fix her hard drive and or computer. Anybody have any experience with repair shops in Ottawa? If you do, just drop a note in the chat window or open your mic and tell us all about it. The only one I've seen recently is, Canada Computers certainly have technicians at the front door. And Gail says Canada Computers, so maybe she uses them. And I think Best Buy have a tech support group. I've got no experience with any of these people. Elizabeth's suggesting Trailing Edge and Bell's Corners. So some suggestions there anyway. So we're right on 8:30. If anybody has any final questions, now's the time to shout out. Or we're going to move on to the wrap-up stage.
I do have a question.
Go ahead.
Do you hear me? This is Claudette Cadet speaking. I had a previous question about the the WPA, and thanks for your suggestion, Chris. I will follow up on that. But I was also reading, I'm not sure if I do have WPA2 set up. I was trying to turn on the the DNS, also the DNS, which give access to private network to the internet. Let me see now. I wrote something here and I couldn't send it. I push on file and it won't go. I don't know what's wrong. It will just give me access to Dropbox, Microsoft OneDrive, Google Drive. Anyways, I'll read to you. Turning DDNS on gives access to my network through the internet. If turning dynamic DNS on, requires username, password, and host name. Is that where you secure the network?
No, that's completely different, and I would not turn that on.
You would not turn that on?
No, I wouldn't. Dynamic DNS is only really of concern if you are trying to access your computer from the internet, and that is a very, very bad idea. Unless you really, really know what you're doing and what the risks are, exposing your computer to the internet is going to invite attackers for sure. So definitely don't turn on that. Don't turn on remote administration. Touch base with me offline, and if you send me an email, my email address is on our website, or it's chris.taylor@opcug.ca. Let me know the make and model of your router, and I can get the manual for it off the internet, and then I can make some recommendations on what screens to go to and what to change them to. So yeah, touch base with me offline, and we can go through it together.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much.
No problem.
And Deb is telling Micheline that her computer technician, the other Chris S., is one of the best technicians in the city, and she's given Micheline a phone number to call. Okay, so moving along. Everybody who is a paid-up member of the Otto PC user group, if you are at the AGM, you would know that you're getting a one-year extension and free and clear of all charges on your membership, so you won't need to renew for at least another year. And if you have friends or relatives who desperately want to join the club, if they do that before March the 31st and pay us $20, then they too will get a 3 years membership. So they'll get 2 years for the price of one, which is a bit like that beer advert, but it's even better. We give you 2 years for the price of one membership. Some upcoming things. OPL Tech Cafe is starting again in March. And I'm going to be talking about free software on Monday, March the 1st at 4 o'clock. Our next monthly meeting is on March the 10th, and it will be our favorite raconteur, Chris Taylor, who will be helping you keep your passwords safe from hacking eyes. And our next question and answer session will, of course, be next week, February 24th. If you have any questions, you have topics that you want to share, or you have answers to all of the problems in the world, please send along your comments to suggestion box, and we'll do our best to include them in the next session. So thanks very much, everyone, for attending. I hope you found it interesting, and we'll see you all next week.
Yeah, thanks all for coming out, and we'll see you next week. And we are no longer